and welcome to South Africa on 99.94. I'm Neil Manthorpe. My co-host, as always, is Lungani Zama. Sorry we've not been online for some time. It's been out of our control. But we are back with you now, and I'm talking to you from the lesser city of Kimberley on the England tour. I've just been in Bloemfontein for the first two games, and I'm delighted to say that that is the topic that we're going to begin with on this episode, because I think that I have the privilege of commentating on one of the great white ball innings in the history of South African cricket from Captain Themba Bavuma, as England were beaten for the fifth time in a row, for the first time since before 2015, when their one-day team was revolutionised. South Africa chasing 343 for victory to win that series, and Bavuma produced one of the great statement innings in white ball cricket, certainly in South Africa's history. It was absolutely extraordinary, not just because of the personal circumstances, what the captain has been through for the last 6 or even 12 months, everything that was resting on his shoulders, the possibility, even the probability of not qualifying automatically for the World Cup in October later this year. And he's gone out there and scored 100 off 90 balls. Just truly extraordinary. I mean, the list of pressures that he was under, Lungani, and I am assuming that you share my enthusiasm for the quality of that innings and the character that it showed.
Yeah, look, it was, given the circumstances that you've just listed, man, is definitely one of the great pressure knocks, you know. And I think the way that they've actually approached both these matches, I thought South Africa were dead and buried in the first ODI, when England were 140 without loss, chasing just under 300. And the way that they've turned that around set the tone for chasing 350. So yeah, you've got to give credit. I think I've certainly given a lot of criticism over the last few months of the team and the way that it's played and the attitude that they've played. And I think what they've done in Bloemfontein over the past few days has been extraordinary, especially when, as you say, they had to win the series in order to give themselves a chance to qualify automatically for the World Cup. And they've done that with a game to spare. So really well played by them. And as you say, Themba's innings on Sunday was one of such clarity and purpose. You know, if that's the player that he will turn himself into, then you can see that batting order batting around him, and there's freedom for the likes of Quinton and Rassi and Markram and Miller in the middle order to play as they play. You know, that there was definitely a lot more purpose and energy and intent about his innings. And I think, to be fair, his dismissal probably had as much to do with cramp as anything else. But yeah, getting to 100 was a hell of an innings, really.
Let's just rewind to the first game. And my dear friend, Rashid van der Dusen, I think, was very upset by some of the criticism that came his way and the team's way in the first game. Now, it's hard to criticise, and you're loathe to criticise when a team puts 300 on the board. But I felt that there was a lack of killer instinct in that first game. I think that a par score, we said all along, even before the game started, when we looked at the pitch, we thought a par score was going to be 330, 340, and that turned out to be the case in the second game. But, you know, Rassi scored 100, and it was his fourth 100, and it was his second against England. And South Africa won by 27 runs. So, you know, it's understandable if he turns around and goes, hey, we won by 27 runs. You know, why are you criticising me? But his first 50 came off 63 balls. His second 50 came off 57 balls. He didn't accelerate. I felt there was a lack of killer instinct. And when Jason Roy and David Milan added 146 to the first wicket, I think it's fair to say that England messed up the run chase. You know, it was thanks once again to the bowlers. Sisanda Magala was outstanding on his return to the national team, and Anrich Nolkia was brilliant. They took 7 wickets between them. And I just said that they got a bit lucky. And once again, it was the bowlers who won the game. And I felt that Rassi is a better player. If he is just an anchor player and he scored a run a ball 100, not quite even a run a ball 100, then, you know, he did his job. But I felt that it's one thing if a batsman tries to accelerate and the bowling's too good in the death overs, but I just felt that he went at one pace and set his the bar too low, the target too low at 300. And South Africa, ordinarily, I think, against an efficient, settled England team, would have lost that first game. So, yeah, and I know, as I said, you know, you're loath to criticise. It was a brilliant victory, but one that Magala and Norkia should be given credit for.
Yeah, I can't understand how England actually lost that game from when they were after that opening stand. You've got to give credit to the bowlers. And I said, I think at halftime, I said, I felt South Africa were even almost 100 short given what they could have scored and knowing what England can do. And halfway through the innings, I mean, I didn't see the betting on it, but I'm pretty sure people were ready to pay out for England at 140 without loss with that many overs to spare and the way that Roy and Malan were batting. It was, like you say, an extraordinary collapse. And I would think that, you know, deep down, even Rassie, with the criticism, took the lesson and said, look, I did make 100, but it wasn't 100 that hurt England because they never felt that the run rate was getting out of hand. And the way that they played, it kind of is the way that teams will approach the World Cup, especially in India and flat tracks. It's going to be 350 scores. I mean, if you look at the series between India and New Zealand and a few others, that's the par score. You know, run a ball, teams are cantering in with five overs to spare. I think the more realistic total on a pitch that was probably harder to bat on was England's 340 on Sunday, where they still finished strong. And that's what you do. You know, you've got to go hard in those 10 overs and almost treat it like the latter stages of a T20 innings to put the pressure on, because run a ball these days doesn't scare any international team. It needed a big helping hand from England, some very good bowling from Magala and Norkia, like you said, but England shot themselves on the foot there. Any other day, if there was a knockout game, I'm sure they would have approached it differently, but they have the luxury of knowing that they've already qualified for the World Cup.
Okay, we'll take a short break and be back with more of this ODI series in just a second.
Hi, I'm Nikesh Raghani, commentator and host of the India on 99.94 podcast. Several times each week, my co-host Sarah Waris and I will be bringing you the very best in Indian cricket chat, whether we're discussing the legend of Julan Goswami, KL Rahul's strike rate, the men's T20 death bowling woes, or the latest controversy involving the BCCI. We've got you covered. You can listen and subscribe via your usual podcast provider. Just search for India on 99.94. You can watch us via YouTube, and you can download the 99.94 app. If you love Indian cricket, then join our conversation.
Okay, lots to talk about, lots to look forward to, and lots of scenario planning for qualification for the World Cup. But I'm sorry, I can't move on from Themba Bavuma. We haven't paid enough credit to him yet. do you know, it was really interesting. I think we all know what is written on the top of Joss Butler's bat. I'm not sure we can say it. The F word, F it, is what's written on his bat. And it just seemed to me that everything that is weighing has been weighing on Themba Bavuma's shoulders. I think he's pressed his own F it button. And when he went out there to bat, as I said, he just redefined himself. He's going, I'm not anchoring this. I'm not putting up with all this shit that people have been giving me for the last year. He's not the only captain to have captained a South African team to an inglorious exit from a World Cup. But he might have become the first captain, and I suppose he might still become the first captain to fail to lead his team to a World Cup. All the criticism, failing to attract a bid at the player auction for the SA20, the new coaches, which we'll talk about in just a second, you know, refusing to guarantee him the captaincy. All of that, I think he's just walked out there and it's almost like the pressure was too much and he's just gone, F it. You know what, I'm going to play some shots here. And he's such a calm, sensible, self-effacing man. But when he scored the 100th run, that celebration brought tears to the faces of, I would suggest, many thousands of South Africans. And I tell you what, I had a lump in my throat in the commentary box.
Yeah, I think you recognize the hardships over the last, like we say, a few months at the very least. And it's all happened pretty publicly. Just about every single person in that squad had come from SA20, which has taken South Africa by storm. He would have been sitting, watching on the sidelines, you know, knowing that when it comes back, the pressure is going to be on him to reprove, because he hasn't had a few weeks of hit and giggle. And I think on a personal note, you know, there was a family bereavement, which in the middle of the SA20, while everyone else was having a party, you know, there was a really personal tragedy at home. So there's been a lot going on in his life. So to be able to summon all that up and score, and not just a sort of freebie 100, it was 100 that mattered, chasing 340 plus in a game that you had to win the series. You know, it was an innings of consequence. You know, there's sometimes you score cheap runs and you go, oh, well, there was no pressure. There was definitely a lot of pressure on that. And it's not as if his mindset changed for that second game. In the first game, he was going quicker than Quinton de Kock as well, until he mistimed one of Moen Ali. So you don't know what conversations have been had with Shukri Conrad and Rob Walter. So, I mean, we're not privy to the conversations that, you know, he might have had with Shukri Conrad and Rob Walter, the new coaches. But as we've said before, a new coach comes in and everyone's on trial again. And he definitely Themba batted like somebody trying to prove a point, whether to himself, to the team, to the coaches, to the public. You know, there was a lot of people to remind. And I think, you know, patting his name and that emotional celebration when he got to 100 was a release of months of tension and hurt and frustration and all of it. It's been a tough period. So it was an innings of character, like you said.
We talk about white ball cricket as if 20 over cricket and 50 over cricket are the same. And for a guy like Themba Bavuma, they are profoundly different. I mean, he's not a power hitter. But, you know, I am perplexed at just how little credit he's given for his ODI record. That was his third 100. He scored 290s as well in 21 innings. That innings pushed his average up to 46. He's an outstanding 50-over cricketer.
Yeah, I mean, he looks comfortable in the format, and it's not quite the relentless pressure of carting every ball as T20 is. And I mean, you say he's not a power hitter. He's not in the true sense of the word. But there was a six that he cracked on Sunday, almost out of nowhere. And, you know, it's there. And I suppose it's a mindset thing and being given the freedom to play again or finding the freedom to play your strikes freely again, because the shot's all there. You don't play international cricket if you can't play. So the shots are there, and you'd like to think that it's hopefully a corner turned, because he's the captain, and you need your captain performing. And I'm sure that dressing room and the training over the last couple of days has been a far more cheerful place for every single player, because it eases the tension. You know, you know the scrutiny that your captain is under. Regardless, when he's not performing, it's ramped up even more. And I'm sure all those players are just as thrilled as he was in doing what he did and in the manner that he did it, against, you know, the best white ball team in the last few years. There were some serious bowlers in that England lineup. You know, we can't discount that. So his celebrations were justified. The relief in the team is justified, given that they've now won the series. And they can, you know, look forward and plan on bigger things. And hopefully they've also turned a corner in the way that they play, because that's definitely the most concerted positivity that you've seen from a South African team just about this year. In the last year, anyway.
Let's talk about leadership and captaincy. And I do differentiate between the two of them, because captaincy doesn't necessarily mean leadership, and vice versa. So the South African squad, well, both squads came together at the last minute, you know. I mean, in cricketing terms anyway, they were sort of thrown together 24 hours before the first game. England had three players coming from Sharjah, only three from England. Eight were in South Africa already in various parts of the country playing in the SA20. As for the South African team, Bavuma said that he spent the 2 weeks before the first game on the beach. He was on holiday, as you said, having suffered a family bereavement as well. And he wasn't going to be playing any cricket. There wasn't any cricket for him to be playing, unless he played a club game, I guess. And I saw Shukri Conrad was one of the first to arrive, and he didn't know. He was concerned. You know, he's a glass three quarters full man, you know, at the best of times. As Temper said, he calls a spade a spade. He doesn't beat about the bush. And you know, but he was concerned. And he said, I don't know what space the guys are in. I don't think that they have had time as a squad to process the departure from the T20 World Cup. And almost all of them were there. It's pretty much the same squad, almost all of them. And Conrad was concerned. And it wasn't until the morning of the day before that they actually got together as a squad, and they were all sitting on the outfield at the Mangoang Oval in Bloemfontein, and it was a long conversation. It was like they were sitting there for over half an hour. I don't know who said what. I was watching them, but I couldn't hear who was talking. But I know that more than one player, you know, did have something to say. But Bavuma was at the heart of it, as was Shukri Conrad. And you know, the way that they came out and they played in those first two games, it was just clear to me. And I want to talk about captaincy as well, Bavuma's captaincy on the field, because I think that has been truly outstanding. But somehow the leadership was also very, very profound. And, you know, I honestly, Zams, because of the situation, I thought the pressure would be too much. I thought that there would be a level of, oh, I don't know, disinterest is the right word, but I just feared for the team during this series. I thought they'd get beaten, and somehow they have pulled together, and I think Bavuma's at the heart of it.
Yeah, I think that was a national fear that England would just be too strong and they'd just be too powerful. And just more united as a team, given, like you said, the fact that there was really probably one training session where the players had a chance to suddenly gel as a team, having played those who played in the SA20 as, you know, different franchises with different priorities. And now you've suddenly got to, you know, put on the SA jersey and figure it out. So it is. I mean, it is testament to the leadership of the leadership group, and then on the field. You know, Temba, especially in that first one, you might not have picked it up at the stadium, but there was even an argument that the mics picked up with him and KG, when I think KG wanted one more in the middle of the England chase, and Temba was resolute. No, we're holding you to the end. We're holding you to the end. And even as they walked away from the stump mic, you could see KG still talking, and Temba was just smiling at him, but politely saying, "No, we're saving you for the end." So even then, and I think England probably were about two or three down, even then he was thinking, we can still shut this down, and I need my spearhead for the end, because I'm going to need you to close out. So that, you know, that says whatever England needed and whatever wickets they had in hand, you're still thinking that we've got a way to turn this around, and I'm going to need you to finish off in order for us to win. And, you know, obviously there's a lot that goes into captaincy, but that presence of mind to say, let's not use all our ammunition now. Let's think of the bigger picture. Says that, you know, you're still fully aware of the situation and you're still cognizant of what your team needs, regardless of whatever the outside noise is. And we keep saying this, but there has been a lot of noise. There have been a lot of changes. There were outcries for a lot of the guys who starred in the SA20 to be part of this new revolution and change the squad completely. And you know, credit to the selectors as well, because they could have been tempted to change four or five, as we thought they might. And they've stuck to their guns, and those players have rewarded that loyalty with really a seasoned performance against the world champions.
Okay, another short break and then we'll talk more captaincy in a moment.
Whether it's missing flights or retirements out of the blue, whether it's resignations or bans, as the old saying goes, there's never a quiet day in West Indies cricket. So make sure you listen to West Indies on 99.94 to stay up to date with all the latest fallout with the teams in maroon.
Can I just finish off this section talking about captaincy on the field? And I wasn't actually on commentary at the moment, that conversation was taking place between KG and the captain. But it's interesting. I mean, there were lots of very interesting exchanges that we did hear on the stump microphone. But do you know what's really interesting? I said after the second game, after Temba's 100, and I was chatting to him, and I said, your captaincy has been amazing. You know, if there's one thing on either side that's better than your 100, it's been your captaincy. Everything that he did, every bowling change that he made worked for him. And captains will tell you that you need luck, and you know, you can pull the strings, but the bowlers still need to put the ball in the right place and take wickets and change the course of the game. But he then, even, you know, in 12 months, which has had so few highs for him personally, he was still of a mind to share the credit of the captaincy. And he said, well, I haven't been playing for the last couple of weeks. I haven't been playing any cricket, you know, and it's been hasn't been easy to get back into the nuance and the flow of the game. Fortunately, everyone else has been playing cricket, so I've been able to tap into their experience. And I'm thinking, no, Temba, you're the captain. You're making those calls. But it's just so typical of him that you know, even at this one moment, he did say, well, I'm not one to blow hot air up my own, you know what. It was his exact words. But, you know, I thought, come on, Temba, blow some hot air up your ass and do it. You know, you deserve it.
Yeah, look, I think experience has taught him that you stay humble at the best of times, because tomorrow is another opportunity for detractors to come and remind you of all of the failures. But, like, you know, like you say, as he pointed out, there's a core of leadership there, whether it's Rassie van der Dusen, Quinton de Kock behind the stumps, KG himself, Kesh Maharaj, you know, there's an experience. David Miller, there's guys, you know, on patrol constantly, whether they're leading the fielding unit or reminding the spinners or the bowlers. There's a core there, and he does lean on them, and it's no secret. There's a shared responsibility, because your eyes and ears can't be everywhere at all times, and there is a bit of an understanding that you are allowed to speak up. You know, some captains prefer to take it upon themselves and take all the credit and you take all the blame, and that makes them feel more comfortable. But certainly his leadership style has always been a more democratic, and you know, I think that's probably one of the big reasons why the team has just been as hurt as, and his loss of form and his struggles, because they know that he shares in much as in their successes. So of course they would share in his failures and feel, you know, pull for him. And I think you saw the reaction when he got to 100. You know, that entire dressing room got up and was, you know, it was proper. I think there was even a message thumping his chest, pointing towards the dressing room, because cheapers, goodness knows how much he's had to lean on them, and they've sort of probably kept on playing psychologist even in the darkest of times. So, you know, that's the essence of a team, and I'm sure they'll look back on that series as a turning point as they look towards the World Cup and say, it might have been easier to just tear the thing apart and start again, but the fact that we stuck together and supported each other back into the light probably means more, because they can all still play cricket. You know, they can all still take wickets and make runs. Sometimes you need to remind yourself and those around you that you still can. Once you do, you know, you take that resilience that you've built up and you express it on the field. And that's what they've done over the last couple of games. And there's another game in Kimberley where they will obviously try and ram the point home and win emphatically and finish really strong before people go off to SA20 and wherever else. But yeah, it's good to see the team in the short space of time that they had, as united as they were and as happy to share in each other's successes as they have been.
So I think KG Rabada was always going to be rested out of the second game. But I think that a plan was formed, player rotation, before the series began. And I think it was always, KG, I want you to play the first game. You can have the second game off. Then we'll see about the third game where the series is placed. I know that Rabada was tired. And I think almost he's as tired by the constant weight on his shoulders as much as the physical tiredness. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know how tiring it's been playing for the Mumbai Indians, Cape Town in the SA20. I don't think that's particularly physically tiring, but and so it was wonderful to see Magala step up and Andrik Norkia, who's played just about every game for South Africa. Since you know, before the Australia tour. I mean, I'm sure that Norkia probably needs a tactical rest at some point. Marco Janssen, just every time he picks up a bat and a ball, he's just looking more and more like he can become a genuine all-rounder. But Magala particularly, you know, we talk about the effort button for Bavuma. I kind of got the sense from Magala as well, you know, because of all the nonsense that he's been through, you know, that, I mean, he's been actually picked in squads and then rejected. Like, sorry, you knew what shape I was. You knew how much I weighed when you picked me. And then I turn up and you go, no, sorry, you're overweight. You know, off you go. I mean, how irritating would that be? More than irritating.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of personal trauma stories within that squad. But somehow, obviously, when they've got onto the field, they've let their cricket do the talking. And I think, yeah, Sisando Magala has been a talking point around South African cricket for a couple of years now, because every single player that he plays against, everyone who watches him on a regular basis, says he's definitely South Africa's most skilled bowler at the death, consistently. Every batsman that's faced him is, you know, surprised for the first time at how heavier ball he bowls. And then his fitness issues have been well documented. I mean, you know, they've had to come out and be clear. It's going back to the days of Graham Smith picking him in the squad but not picking him in the 11 and saying that there's things like skin folds and all sorts of criteria. So like you say, you know, you kind of go, well, why did you pick me in the first place? If your policy is that I'm not fit for international cricket, then fair enough. Don't pick me at all. But you understand the temptation of the selectors, because they know what you get. And it is such a precious skill set. And he demonstrated that against England, not just in the death overs, but he's a strike bowler. You know, he surprises you with the range of deliveries that he has. And I don't know, maybe you look at an unfit bowler running up and you don't think he's going to knock you over. But, you know, he did. And you could see again just how chuffed the players around who know what he's got once he got on the field were like, jeepers, thank goodness, you know, here he is. So it was almost unfortunate that he got rested given the fact that he's just turned in that performance. But like you say, there must have been a policy of rotation, and we'll see what team they pick for the third one. But you'd love to see him get another cap to try and build on that, because even when he came into international cricket, as is normally the way with players who've come in under shadow, everything that you do on the cricket field is scrutinized. And when he played the first time he was picked, there were a bunch of no balls that he kept on spraying, obviously nervous. But this is the Magala that's dominated South African cricket, the one that you saw on Friday night in Bloemfontein. That's the Magala that South African domestic cricket knows. And it's great to see him finally doing that on the international stage.
It's not a fitness issue, is it? It clearly, I mean, it's not a fitness issue. It's a shape issue. Because there's no question that he's fit enough. He's had less fitness issues than any quick bowler in the country for the last three or four issues. It's an aesthetic issue. You know, people are going like, oh, you don't look like an international athlete. But, I mean, so it's skin folds, and it's the fact that he can't run 2 kilometres in under 8.5 minutes. I mean, I don't know. Do I even need to ask you what your view is on shape issues?
Well, I don't know if I could run 2 kilometres in 8.5 minutes, so I'm not best placed. But he can, obviously, and he did, which is why he's there. But yeah, it is an aesthetic thing, and there's still those who say that, you know, he doesn't look like he should be an international cricketer. How much more would he do if he was fitter? But, you know, some people have gone and transformed their bodies, and it just, it's not the same, because you learn to work with that weight. And actually, the minute that you are imbalanced in your head, you can't deliver. There's a lack of intensity, and there's a lack of the quality that you had, because you're not the shape that you've grown accustomed to, which is crazy. But, like, you know, a big Magala is a great asset to a bowler, to a captain, to throw the ball at in the death overs. And he's shown that again and again in domestic cricket, and now he's showing it on the international stage. So it's up to the selectors to work it out.
Indeed it is. And I'm very, very glad. Hey, look, he did lose a lot of weight. I mean, he's still big. He's still bigger than your average international fast bowler. But frankly, you know, in first class cricket, he bowls you 20 overs a day without change of pace. Anyway, thank you very much indeed for listening to South Africa on 99.94. Do please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy your podcasts. And you can download the 99.94 app and follow us on Twitter at Neil Manthorpe and at WamZam17. For now, cheerio.
Running should be simple. Just put on your shoes and go. And yet, when you try to learn about how to get better at it, especially as you age, you're confronted with conflicting advice, complicated workouts, and confusing nutrition trends that just won't work for you. On The Planted Runner, I'll share exactly how to run faster, longer, and feel great doing it at any age, because you don't have time to waste. I'm Coach Claire Bartholik, and I went from not running at all in my late 30s to finishing a marathon in 2:58 at age 42, all on a plant-based diet. I've helped hundreds of runners achieve new personal records well into their 60s and even 70s with science-backed training, plant-based nutrition, and proven mental strength techniques. Each episode of The Planted Runner is like a private coaching session on the run, where you'll learn from me and the guests I interview. You'll get actionable lessons to help you become a better runner every week and reach goals you never thought possible. Whether you're training for your first 5K or your 50th marathon, take along The Planted Runner on your next run. Let me show you how your best running is still ahead of you.